I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, radio in Belgium and Russia, vinyl in the 1950s and a new gold CD library, the BBC in Southampton, a shake-up at County Sound in Guildford, a new low-cost infrared camera, and the applicants for the second national UK radio franchise, and Kodak kills off cinema digital sound. It's all coming up on Sparks from Radio Fax 3910 6205 and 12255.
BBC Radio 4 programme Special Assignment looked at the recordable consumer formats for audio. Here's just a short extract.
And it may be that some of these players will come to cost as little as £80. Like compact discs, both the new formats are digital, which means they use technology derived from computers to represent sound as a series of digits. That makes for pure and clear reproduction, which doesn't distort or wear out. Above all, both are recordable. One uses tape and the other a tiny disc like a CD. Sony's new baby is the Minidisc, a portable machine which has a shock-proof memory. This means the music continues smoothly even if the machine is jogged or bumped around. Eric Kingdom of Sony describes the disc itself.
To most people, particularly if you've worked in an office, if you look at it, it looks like a little computer diskette. It's 2.5 inches in diameter, and it's completely enclosed in a little plastic caddy. You can store 74 minutes of digital audio on the one disc. And the access time is the same as CD. That is to say, you can access any track on it within round about 1 second flat.
The Philips system is called Digital Compact Cassette, or DCC for short. The tapes are the same size as normal old-fashioned cassettes, but they play digital quality music. Jerry Wirtz is based at Philips' Dutch headquarters in Eindhoven, where he has nursed the DCC project through from the very start. He told us how the new cassettes differ from the old.
Well, I think the major difference is that this is a real pretty-looking, very attractive cassette. It's completely different from the actual cassette. Its top is completely closed, and it has the graphics of the artists and the songs on top of the cassette. It actually looks a little bit like a miniature CD box if you look from the front. If you turn it around, you can see the slider, which is a bit like the floppy disk kind of thing people are familiar with. And this is also already indicating the other major difference. This is a digital cassette, so it has the same kind of quality you get from a compact disc. Which means that this time we're bringing in the market a product which has the convenience of a cassette you can carry in all your personal cassette players with you, but is delivering you in exactly the same quality as what you get out of a CD player.
The biggest selling point of DCC is something called, in the technical jargon, backwards compatibility. What it means is that you can play old-fashioned cassette tapes in the new machine, though they won't, of course, be digital quality.
Leslie Cohen there, reporting for Special Assignment on Radio 4.
Pirate radio stations broadcast across the band from the old Soviet Union. In Radio World, the rock music of Belamore Canal is between 1605 kHz and 1820 kHz, just above the medium wave band, along with Syndicat, Agat, Orbit, Cardinal and System. A second set of pirates operate from 2000 to 2400 kHz, with such names as Boulder, Ivanovna, Ducat, Colosse, Exotique and Mirage. And now some pirates use the Western International Pirate Radio waveband of 48 metres. Which is, of course, also where you'll find Radio Fax's 6205 frequency.
Jimi Hendrix sampled. The music of Jimi Hendrix is set to emerge in a new form. The album, backed by the Hendrix Estate in the United States, has been put together by Duncan Kane and Luke Baldry, band members of The Beautiful People. Working at home with a Tascam MSR24S tape machine, Soundtracks PC MIDI mixer and Akai S1000 sampler, they have constructed new tracks using Hendrix vocals and guitar breaks, including 5 previously unheard guitar solos. The project began when Kane and Baldry put a Hendrix house track together in 1989, foreseeing a fusion of house with 60s-style music. A copy was sent to the Hendrix estate with a request for permission to press a few white labels for club use. They came back to us and asked us to do an album for them, said Kane. They'd heard a lot of sampled Hendrix, which hadn't been Jimmy enough, but felt what we'd done was much more Hendrix. The album was made under the supervision of Alan Douglas, a close friend of Hendrix, who has been involved with many other posthumous albums from the artist. No record deal has been signed, but promotional dance mixes by producer and remixer Youth at Metropolis Studios in London are bound to generate interest. That report by Caroline Moss.
In Belgium, the political problems of a 3-community system of government are impacting on radio stations as French stations expand while Flemish stations suffer a clampdown. The French community government, headed by President Valmy Fer, has granted 9-year licenses to Radio Contact and Bell RTL for stereo networks covering the various French-speaking territories. Meanwhile, the Flemish government has gone ahead with anti-network legislation, which has forced several networks off-air and caused redundancies. About 150 Flemish radio stations are in the firing line for exceeding the 20% limit on syndicated programming, giving incorrect station calls or other administrative errors. Broadcasters throughout the country are now hoping that the recent elections will hasten the introduction of a more coherent legislative framework. That by Mark Mace in ProSound News Europe. letter from Mr. Enric Roca from Barcelona in Spain. I enjoy Radio Facts every night of the week, listening to interesting news and good music, especially the specials music of the 70s decade. I'm a DXer since 1978. My favourite DXing is shortwave and FM in the summertime. Here in Barcelona, it's easy to catch hundreds of Italian FM stations during the summer period. Well, he listens to Radio Facts on a Sony CFS-DW50L radio cassette. And 6205 is the frequency. He's on a mountain 150 metres high over Barcelona and just uses the telescopic aerial. Sometimes your radio signal is very strong with good and clear listening here. The best time is between 1 and 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, thanks very much for that letter. And first of several this week from Canada, from Edward Kuzelik in Coaldale, Alberta. I just had the great pleasure of hearing your shortwave radio transmission, and therefore I'm writing to inform your staff on how your signals are being heard here in Canada. This was my first opportunity to actually hear your station, and it was quite a thrill indeed to hear your programming and the clear station IDs for Radio Facts. And he requests any pennants and radio decals. Well, we can send you our station card and an artist's impression, which, whilst not triangular-shaped, is at least a picture of some sort. He's listening on 6205, incidentally. And I hope atmospheric conditions improve so I may have the future opportunity to hear your station again. Well, look forward to hearing from you again, Edward Kuzelik. Listening in Canada on a JVC NRD525 comms receiver with a 12-metre 300-ohm twin-lead TV wire, making a loop back to the receiver's input.
A room-temperature infrared camera in electronic engineering. As part of a European collaboration on automotive electronics, a thermal infrared camera that operates at room temperature without the need for cooling has been developed that could be produced cheaply enough to mount on a boat to aid visibility to prevent disasters such as the Marchioness. The camera is being used by a team from Lucas Automotive, Jaguar and Pilkington, and is mounted in a concept vehicle as part of the Prometheus program. The technology has been developed under MOD funding by the Royal Signals and Radar Establishment, RSRE, at Malvern, using a material developed by the GEC Marconi Materials Technology Group at Caswell for the imaging element. The prototype used in the Prometheus has been built by RSRE, who are negotiating the production of the camera with a number of companies, including GEC Sensors at Basildon, Essex. The key to the camera is the sensing element, a 100 by 100 starring array of pyroelectric elements. The pyroelectric effect is the same consequence of permanent dipoles that leads to the piezoelectric effect, except the degree of polarization depends on the temperature of the material. The use of a starring array generates a heat map with a one-to-one correspondence between the image and the data, and this means that the element does not require an optical scanning method, such as raster scan, which reduces the complexity of the camera. The drawback of the one-to-one correspondence is that to get a better spatial resolution, a larger array must be used, or the field of view reduced. The material used has a Curie temperature of around 300 degrees centigrade. This is the temperature at which the spontaneous polarization disappears, and the high temperature of the Curie point allows the sensors to operate over a wide temperature range, including room temperature, with high sensitivity. An image is focused through a solid germanium lens onto the array, which has a thermal absorber on top. As the temperature of each element varies, the polarization changes. The element temperature changes by 80 microkelvins for each 1 degree Kelvin change in the scene temperature, producing 150 microvolts of signal on a detector capacitance of 1 picofarad. The RMS noise equivalent of the element is 0.2 Kelvin, but the minimum resolution of 0.1 Kelvin is based on the perception of the image by a viewer. The temperature is determined by measuring the voltage from the illuminated element and comparing this with the voltage generated from the element with a constant reference image. This reference is supplied by a mechanical chopper in front of the array, giving a constant temperature. The value from the image is digitized and stored, and then subtracted from the digitized reference value. The values are read by a MOSFET network on the hybrid substrate, which is synchronized with the chopper. The chopper operates at 50 Hz, and the elements are sampled at the maximum and minimum values of the voltages as the reading changes from the image to the reference and back again. The sensor itself operates over the temperature range of minus 30 to plus 40 degrees C. The array in the prototype camera is monolithic, so that the 100 by 100 array is defined by the electrodes on the ceramic material. One of the problems is that the heat in one area tends to spread into other elements, especially if there is a particularly hot object in the image, and that reduces the resolution. RSRE have developed a reticulation process where the elements are separated by a 10 micrometer gap, that is, photochemically etched into the ceramic. This reduces the lateral thermal spread, improving the resolution of the sensor. The elements are mounted directly onto the silicon readout chip using a good electrical but bad thermal contact to maintain good thermal isolation. This is achieved by keeping the area to volume ratio of the solder connections low to give a limited thermal connection. The element also has to have vibration taken into account, as the pyroelectric element is also piezoelectric, and compression of the ceramic also causes a change in voltage. The field of view of the camera can be set by choosing an appropriate lens. For example, a 50mm lens produces a field of view of 12 degrees. Larger arrays than the current 100 by 100 are planned. The prototype camera currently uses around 9 watts of power, but a production version would reduce this to around 3 watts. GEC Sensors believes that it is possible to manufacture the camera now for £10,000 per unit, and in the long term of 2 to 3 years they could more than halve the cost to less than £5,000. For applications such as a boat camera, this cost per unit could be possible in 1 to 2 years. The cost-sensitive areas are the sensor, where research should reduce the cost, but a cost-limiting factor is the IR transparent germanium optic. These lenses are ground from germanium crystal that is mined in the same way as quartz, making them an expensive part of the system. One area for further research has to be the development of a low-cost material, transparent in the 8 to 12 micrometer range, that is easily manufactured into optical elements. GEC Sensors expects to double the spatial resolution of the prototype camera for a production model, and the three PCBs for the signal processing in the prototype have been combined into one using surface mount techniques for the production model. All about a high-sensitivity infrared camera which operates at room temperature, from Electronic Engineering.
And Kodak has withdrawn major funding from the development of cinema digital sound, and its research partner, Californian-based Optical Radiation Corporation, has also slashed its investment and put its stake in CDS up for sale. When CDS was previewed in London in 1991, broadcast experts praised its audio quality, which allows a 6-track discrete digital mix to be heard in any converted cinema. But the system is a purely digital one, which is a problem for the analog film industry. For any transition to digital cinema audio, an analogue compatibility is needed for the next 15 years at least. CDS met stiff resistance in America from film studios and cinemas who were reluctant to install expensive new technology, which was incompatible with existing analogue techniques. Dolby's rival SRD cinema analog and digital audio system has already been demonstrated in Europe and is likely to start installation later this year. Listening in Ballingarry in County Limerick in Ayr is Noel Carmody. Hello to him. And Gary Veraldi listens in Tara in Canada. He reports some deep fades, so my details at best are scanty. He is listening using an analogue Yaesu FRG7 and listening on 6205. I'm a 27-year-old radio announcer and I collect QSLs and pirate radio tapes. I definitely hope you will return this and trust the legal authorities will be gentle, 73s and fight for free radio. Well, thanks to Gary Veraldi. And if you'd like to write in from wherever you're listening, we'd love to have your letter, and I guarantee to say hello to you on air. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. And if you send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1, then we'll send back our station card and some technical information sheets and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. So the address again is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
Used to be a dollar, now it's $1.33. They got sale tax on it. Sale tax on it. Got sale tax on it. Everywhere you go. Know an old lady lives behind the jail. Got a sign on the wall saying liquor for sale. She got the sale tax on it. Sale tax on it. Everywhere you go. And the governor say it's a natural fact. Spend that money, you got to pay that tax. You got the sale tax on it. You got the sale tax on it. You got the sale tax on it. a natural fact. To spend that money, you got to pay that tax. You got to sell tax on it. You got to sell tax on it. You got to sell tax on it. Everywhere you go. Boy.
Here's a piece from The World at One about the battle for the second national radio franchise, and they were, of course, quite wrong in speculating that Capital Radio was going to apply.
...licensed to run Britain's second national commercial radio station, almost certainly a pop service, which is going to broadcast on what is now Radio 3's medium wave frequency. It's the latest stage in the much-heralded expansion of radio channels that listeners were promised, but that so far seems to have been stalled by the recession. The group that won the franchise for the first national station couldn't raise the money, so it was awarded to the runner-up, Classic FM. Our media correspondent Nick Higham now reports on what seems to be happening to the radio revolution.
That's Gary Paget, Union Gap and Young Girl, 6 minutes before 8 o'clock Capital Call time. I want to play one especially for my girlfriend who wanted something with diamonds in it for her birthday present, so I bought her a pack of cards.
The Golden Tones of Tony Blackburn on 1548 AM.
Great to have you with us.
This could be the sound of Britain's first national commercial pop service. On London's Capital Gold, nationally known DJs like Tony Blackburn play records from the last 35 years. Capital could launch a national version, but it's keeping potential rivals guessing about whether it'll bid and what sort of service it's proposing if it does. One man who's not so coy is David Jacobs. When Radio 2 told him it was axing his lunchtime show last year because its listeners were too old, he says he got thousands of letters, which convinced him there was a hole in the market for an easy listening station.
Since my employers have decided that, or my former employers have decided, that I am no longer required on that particular platform, but my listeners seem to think I am, I thought I'd have to build my own platform. Simple as that. I think the listeners that I would be getting would be the ones that Radio 2 has decided not to nurture.
Others believe the hole in the market lies with younger listeners.
Atlantic 252.
Good morning, Henry Owens here, mainly dry today.
Atlantic 252 broadcasts pop to much of the UK from a transmitter in Ireland. It's a joint venture between Ireland's RTE and CLT, which owns more than a dozen commercial radio stations across Europe.
Atlantic 252.
Atlantic's manager, Travis Baxter, won't specify what sort of new service they have in mind, but says there are several possibilities.
There are some very attractive, very large niches. And I mentioned country music, not as a red herring, but because I think that is exactly the sort of area where people could find quite a productive line of investigation. Country music as a format has been the dominant format in the States for the last 2 years, beating Top 40 radio.
There are likely to be around half a dozen bidders for the new national license, the second to be offered. The award of the first last year was something of a fiasco. The highest bidder failed to raise enough capital to get started, and the license was offered to the runner-up. This time, the Radio Authority says it'll scrutinise bidders' financial standing much more closely. The first license eventually went to a popular classical service, Classic FM, which promptly saw its original chairman and managing director depart after they fell out with the board. Classic hopes it'll have a new chief executive within 2 or 3 weeks and says it'll start broadcasting in the second half of this year. But advertisers, still reluctant to use commercial radio, are unhappy at the order in which the licenses have been awarded. Lynn Robinson of ad agency Leo Burnett.
Commercially speaking, the first national radio station should have been a very popular station, which would have substantially boosted the overall reach of commercial radio and the overall number of hours listened. And that kind of station would have given a tremendous boost to what is essentially a new advertising medium.
Nevertheless, Classic FM's acting chairman, Henry Meakin, maintains advertisers are enthusiastic about his service.
That isn't the message that we're getting from all the advertising community that we speak to. There is a lot of enthusiasm for this medium, and in fact, there are a number of pointers that indicate that this audience is going to be much larger than we originally hoped.
To succeed, both Classic FM and the winner of today's license will have to battle the BBC for listeners and the recession and advertising agencies' indifference for revenue.
Nick Higham.
The World at One on BBC Radio 4.
Shake-up forced on County Sound in the Surrey Advertiser. Falling audiences for County Sound Radio in Guildford have prompted the biggest shake-up in the station's 9-year history. From May, County Sound will share the airwaves with Crawley-based station Radio Mercury. Aimed at 15 to 45-year-olds, Radio Mercury, which merged with County Sound in August last year, will be broadcast from the FM transmitters now used by County Sound's Premier Radio. A restyled County Sound, aimed at a slightly younger audience, will continue to broadcast, but on medium wave only. Managers hope the changes will reverse County Sound's dwindling audience share, and that the expanded Radio Mercury will prove a hit with its target audience. The changes follow the merger of two radio stations to form Allied Radio Group PLC, which was floated on the stock market last August. Shares in the group have slumped from a high of 27p to just 18.5p this week. The last published figures for County Sound before the merger showed a loss of nearly £130,000. The main changes after May the 4th will be the division of County Sound into Premier, Delta and First Gold will go, and a single County Sound station will broadcast on the AM frequency now used by First Gold. Radio Mercury will broadcast on FM from the transmitters now used for County Sound's Premier Radio. The restyled County Sound will be aimed at 35 to 55-year-olds, with music, local news and features. The switch to medium wave will increase the potential audience, but sound quality will be poorer than on FM. The County Sound studios and newsroom will relocate back to the Friary in Guildford, where the station first went on air in 1983. The Radio Mercury service for West Surrey will include locally based programming between 6am and 6pm on weekdays from the Guildford studio, with music and increased news coverage to appeal to a younger audience. The group's managing director, Mr. John O'Monier, said that changes were needed because County Sound's position in the ratings had slipped from first place to number 4 in terms of audience share in its area, behind BBC Radios 1, 2 and 4. Following the merger, the group carried out a £20,000 audience research survey. This revealed that County Sound audience had gone too old and too upmarket over the last 5 years, Mr. Omania said. We want to bring back those listeners who have deserted the service over the last 6 or 7 years. We welcome the 55-plus age group listener, but the future of our service cannot rest solely on these listeners. We have to deliver the broad audience, he said. While John O'Monier is definitely in charge in whacking Radio Mercury on FM from County Sound's transmitter, isn't he? And the poor old original County Sound ends up on AM and aimed at a younger audience. Very strange. And that also means a loss of the first AM split in this country, First Gold Radio. And what was it they've been saying recently on this programme? That the only way for local independent radio to survive with the coming of national independent radio is to concentrate on their local audiences. Well, we're really going to get that with a Crawley-based service broadcasting all over the Guildford area, aren't we? Never mind. Back to the real world now, and Daniel Hornington's letter from Shallow Lake in Canada. Caught part of your programme at some ungodly hour early this morning. 4 o'clock in the morning, good grief, using my trusty ICOM ICR71A and a 300-foot long wire antenna, good grief. He's listening on 6205 kilohertz and wishes us the best for 1992. Well, slightly nearer home is Mark Palmer from Caversham in Reading. He's writing expressing interest in the recent book from Simon Mason called The Secret Signals, The Euro Numbers Mystery. That's also a book I'm interested in. We're hopefully going to be getting a review copy of that in a few weeks. Every Monday and Tuesday you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. It's our programme of media, scientific and technical news. Andrew Priest writes from Inverness. He asks if RTE are on strike at the moment. 2FM is playing records and commercials with no DJs. I've heard news at 6 o'clock in the evening, and today I heard an announcer say they were closing down at midnight to reopen at 7 in the morning. Incidentally, I heard that on 97FM here in Glasgow with a fairly good signal, a bit hissy but steady. Well, recently they have been on strike, including engineering staff and even the internal post service. RTE, he reports, Radio 1 have had news, speech and music, but I don't think it's their normal programming. Occasionally I've heard Metro Radio and BBC Radio Newcastle on FM in Glasgow, as well as 2FM, and I've heard RTE Radio 1, 2FM and the Irish language station in Inverness. I enjoyed the bit on vinyl versus CDs last week. The last time I was in John Menzies in Inverness, they had 4 vinyl records, all 7-inch singles. One thing I want before vinyl goes is something that plays at 16 RPM. My record player has 4 speeds, but I've never heard anything that plays at 16 RPM. Well, I think they were intended for language learning records and that sort of thing. I've never seen anything either. Another thing you don't get with CDs is silly coloured ones, or picture CDs, messages scratched into the run-out grooves, double-grooved CDs, non-round CDs, e.g. UK-shaped Six Sex Pistols Anarchy, big pictures on sleeves, single-sided ones with drawings scratched on the back, e.g. the Stretch Heads Bross R. Pish EP. Good luck with the Valve Search from Andrew Preece. Thanks for that letter again. And speaking of the Valve Search, do you have any 813 valves in your junk box? We've now used up all our own stocks. So if you have any 813s you don't want and you'd like to see them going to good use, please wrap them up well and send them to us. We'll immediately refund your postage, of course, and put them to good use. The address? Sparks. Radio Fax. The Forge. Cranley. England. GU67BG. And don't forget, if you'd like a reply, which is the station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. Any new radio station in these hard times risks being off the air within days of opening, but FEM FM, to be launched in Bristol next month, is probably the first with a planned lifespan of only 8 days. It will coincide with part of the city's International Women's Festival, starting on the 8th of March, and will, according to its founders, help promote the festival and celebrate women's culture and experiences. There will be a men's hour in mid-evening, incidentally. The £20,000 plus needed to run the station is being raised from sympathisers. Pat Thorne, the fundraiser, hopes it will be an annual event. Anyone who wants to contribute should contact her on 0272 775 135. That's for FEM FM, 0272 775 135.
The London station LBC had a programme about collectors of vinyl records, and then later in the programme they played the first record released using the effect of phasing, and it's not the one we all think of as being the first record with phasing.
You're going to become members and find out where to buy vinyl, where to spot the disappearing trends and so on, and nurture what's left and still kind of buy sufficient to keep the record companies interested in putting a bit more out. And an enterprising young gentleman has just bought a redundant vinyl pressing plant, and he's doing fantastic business.
Really?
So there's an interesting sort of breeze going on out there in that world. It's quite amazing.
Yes, come to think of it, I suppose he could do pretty well, couldn't he, with his own little, the last remaining plastic pressing plants in the UK?
I think so. Yeah. I really do, but it's a long time since Top Rank records were pressed, and it was a short-lived label, but
and,
much
Top Rank, yes, I was going to say, we'll start off, I think, just to get us in the mood, Stu. I think we'll start off with one of these valuable Top Rank records, and this was all fired by somebody who we reckon, from memory, had all but 3 of the Top Rank collection. Lovely label, red and white, I remember it well, but you know a bit about it. You said short-lived?
Short-lived. It actually kicked off about this time of the year in 1959, and the first release is quite well remembered, The Little Drummer Boy by the Harry Simeon Chorale, which was, well, I remember it anyway.
I'm looking to you for inspiration there, Robbie. Blank looks. No, but that was the start. It was very middle of the road, but not a good example of what was to come. What did come between 59 and 62 was akin to the famous London label. Lots of American records, the kind of which were club records of the day.
Right.
Earthy rock and roll, independence everywhere. The kind of things that when you look at the list now and think, did that come out over here? It's hard to believe that records like that were issued. But thanks to Top Rank, they were.
Yeah, and had some, well, Rhythm of the Rain was a fairly big hit, wasn't it?
No, that was on Warner's, to be pedantic. But if you associate Top Rank instantaneously with Freddie Cannon, Gary U.S. Bonds, the Shirelles, people like that. But they would also rub shoulders with their hip releases with the likes of, with due respect, the Knightsbridge Strings, Kenneth Connor and Sheila Buxton.
Uh-huh.
So there was lots of British artists sat almost awkwardly alongside really hot-to-trot hip American club records.
Didn't they have a lot of off-the-wall instrumentals as well?
Very much.
Bee Bumble and the Stingers, was
that
on Top Rank?
Well, the ironical thing about that is that was one of the last two or three releases, and it went to number one when the label was struggling financially. So it endorsed the credibility when the accountants had put it to bed and said it's going to cease as of June 62, which is when it closed down.
Right, Robbie Venster's Nightline. Well, just kick us off with a Top Rank, and this is Tony Fisher. Have you picked it for any particular reason?
Well, yes, unfortunately, because there were so many good records from America, which had been generally sizable hits in the States. They had a big, long top 100, a big, big chart. Over here, the chances of them being successful were much less. This is a great example of a fine quality record from the end of 1959, which was just too good to be a hit here.
Wonderful stuff, and Stu was just telling me as he was playing, he said, Robbie, listen at the phasing, the first phase record. But what was even more interesting, it was a total mistake.
It was. Tony Fisher wasn't, probably still is, married to a wonderful songwriter called Wayne Shanklin, who'd written things like Jezebel and Chanson d'Amour, I mean, really class songs. And he wrote that one and produced his wife on the song in Los Angeles, but wasn't happy with the level of her voice. And the clock was ticking away, and he said to the engineer, can you run the other take that we did 5 minutes ago alongside this one, see if we can get a bit more level into her voice, which he did, and he ran them in sync, which means that they started off at the same time, but naturally they go out of time because they wouldn't be exactly the same take. And suddenly they got this wonderful, ethereal kind of cloud-spinning weirdness, which for 1959 was like, wow, man, this is, wouldn't be freaky, it would be far out there. Right. It would be groovy or something. And they kept it in, and they invented phasing without even knowing it, long before hippie trippy people in the psychedelic era 10 years later.
But was it acknowledged at the time, Stu, there was this fantastic new thing called phasing, or was it thought to have been a mistake?
The word did exist. Phasing did exist. Engineers were using that as part of their everyday jargon, but people couldn't work out what it was, and they weren't sure, and they didn't like gimmickry. Reviewers over here at that time would stamp on it saying, a typical piece of American gimmickry again, that kind of thing. You know?
That from LBC in London. And in Radio World, not just any rock and roll library. In 1988, Helland Broadcast decided to produce Rock and Roll Graffiti, a comprehensive oldies library on compact disc. The library would feature the best and most programmable rock oldies of the 50s and 60s. Months were spent on research. We used record sales statistics, listener request tallies from oldies stations, and auditorium testing. The final count was more than 1,200 songs, released on 50 CDs. After the playlist had been set, we began the task of finding the best-sounding recordings of these tunes. Technical quality was a prime consideration in creating the library, but finding excellent recordings of tunes from 30 and 40 years ago is easier said than done. Various sources were used, commercial CDs, studio analog masters, RDAT dubs, and as a last resort, vinyl recordings. In compiling the library, our preference obviously was a digital source, either a CD or a digital copy of a studio master. However, due to the age of the material, even a digital source was not originally digital. It was an analog recording transferred to CD or DAT. Interestingly, masters of songs from the 50s and 60s usually sound cleaner than those of the later 60s. In the early days of rock, most studios were limited to 2 or 3 track tape recorders. This may have limited the producer's creativity, but it also limited the amount of tape hiss. In the mid-60s, 4 and 8 track recorders came on the scene, most without Dolby. More tracks created more noise. Much of this material was cleaned up with a variable noise gate device, whereby the program audio would control the bandwidth of a low-pass filter. With the bandwidth, depth and attack and release times being program controlled, this unit was able to work some pretty convincing magic to eliminate tape hiss without affecting the musical content of the audio. Another common problem with much source material was phase error. Record producers have never been known for checking stereo material for mono compatibility. Tape equipment of the 50s and 60s was always prone to drift out of azimuth. Again, much stereo material of the 1950s was fine. Stereo master tapes of the multi-track 60s were another story. Many times the entire recording was out of phase, indicating a misaligned 2-track mixdown recorder. This was rectified by introducing a calculated amount of time shift into the leading channel to restore the time alignment of the 2 channels. Problem solved. In other cases, only certain instruments or vocals were out of phase due to a badly aligned multi-track master recorder. In this case, the only solution is somewhat of a compromise. Use whatever time shift is needed to bring the most relevant audio into correct alignment. Another concern in producing Rock and Roll Graffiti was to eliminate the ticks and pops of vinyl. We were able to obtain a studio master for about 80% of the material. For the other 20%, either the source material was vinyl, or it was a commercial CD that was made of vinyl. With some hard-to-find material from the 50s and 60s, some of it quite obscure, it is impossible to avoid vinyl entirely. There are many songs on the library for which tape masters either never existed, or the master tapes were lost or destroyed. Vinyl source material was carefully auditioned. In many cases, we obtained several copies, listening to each disc to determine which pressing was superior. We then transferred each pressing to form a composite master. If only a few ticks or pops were evident, this 30 inches a second analog master was manually edited. If the problems were more severe, we would transfer the material to DAT for digital processing that would virtually eliminate the ticks and pops. Hanky Panky by Tommy James and the Shondells was probably the worst sounding raw audio we had to work with. The master tape for this particular tune was recorded in 1962 at an obscure recording studio. Tommy James never received the tape, only an acetate 45, which by then had been played hundreds of times. That 45 has been the source of the song, used by Roulette ever since. Now you know why it's always sound so scratchy. It always was. Hank Lynn Landsberg, writing in Radio World. Sparks this week, radio in Belgium and Russia. Vinyl in the 1950s and a new gold CD library. The BBC in Southampton. A shake-up at County Sound in Guildford. A new low-cost infrared camera. The applicants for the second UK national radio licence. And Kodak kills off cinema digital sound.
The Philips DC777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM-FM tuner and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard-size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shelving list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997 or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
In the Financial Times, little-known group makes top bid for radio channel by Raymond Snoddy.
a previously unknown radio company, Independent National Broadcasting, submitted the highest bid of five applicants for the UK's second national commercial radio channel. INBC bid £4.01 million a year for the franchise, more than double the second highest bid of £1.88 million, submitted by Independent Music Radio, a joint venture between Mr. Richard Branson's Virgin Communications and TVAM, the commercial breakfast television station that recently lost its franchise. INBC plans to broadcast pop and rock music from its headquarters in Sheffield. It has been set up by three individuals and, at the moment, does not appear to have heavyweight financial support. The three are Mr. Michael Mallett, chairman of Yorkshire Radio Network until the group was taken over by Metro Radio in 1990, Viscount Lewisham, who was involved in an unsuccessful bid for Yorkshire Television's franchise, and Mr. Toby Horden, a former managing director of Tees Radio. Mr. Mallett, INBC chairman, conceded that the company had not yet raised the planned £12 million needed for the radio station. A prospectus will be issued in the next few weeks. Rivals predicted that INBC would go the way of Showtime, which bid the highest amount for the first national commercial channel last year, but could not complete its financing. The franchise went instead to Classic FM. Mr. Bruce Gingell, chairman of TVAM, said yesterday, "There is no doubt about it, we are the hot favourites." The Radio Authority, embarrassed by Showtime's failure, will be looking closely at the applicants' business plans. The Radio Authority, the industry regulatory body, will award the licence to the highest cash bidder, meeting basic requirements on programming and financial viability. It will use AM frequencies at present used by BBC Radio 3 and should offer 85% coverage of the UK. The INBC application is supported by letters from two stockbrokers, Wise Speak of Newcastle upon Tyne and Peel Hunt of London. Mr. Christopher Hunter, director of Peel Hunt, said he had received expressions of interest from financial institutions that had been told the annual rate of return to the investor might be as high as 34% to 35%. Capital Radio, the UK's largest commercial broadcaster, surprised the industry by not bidding. The other bidders were 2020 Radio, a consortium including Chiltern Radio, which bid £1.31 million and planned to broadcast adult contemporary music. Score Radio, a consortium put together by Glasgow's successful Radio Clyde group, which bid £701,000 and planned to broadcast music from the 50s to the 80s. National Rock Radio, a joint venture between Ireland's national broadcaster RTE and CLT of Luxembourg, which bid just £211,000. The winner will have to pay an annual licence fee of £645,000 and 4% of revenue to the Treasury. That was the Financial Times. In the Independent, poor signal from commercial radio. Not long ago, it was thought that the arrival of national commercial radio would be the saviour of the radio sector. Squeezed between television on one side and the printed media on the other, radio has only been able to command 2% of advertising revenue, less than half the proportion in most other developed countries. National radio, the logic went, would increase awareness and persuade advertisers to believe it worthwhile to commit large chunks of their budgets to the medium. Alas, the award of the national FM franchise was a debacle, and having seen the bids for the AM franchise, it looks as if that is going the same way. The Radio Authority awarded the FM franchise to the highest bidder, Showtime Radio, which could not come up with the funds. The franchise then moved to Classic FM, which responded by having a boardroom split and losing its managing director. It has yet to appoint another, and many believe Classic will not be on the air by its announced autumn starting date. Highest bidder for the AM franchise is the Independent National Broadcasting Company, headed by Michael Mallett, former chairman of Yorkshire Radio Network, and backed by the banker and prospective Tory candidate Tony Horton. Its bid of £4.01 million a year was more than twice that of its nearest rival, the joint venture of Virgin and TVAM. Fancied candidate National Rock Radio, backed by CLT of Luxembourg and RTE of Ireland, bid just £210,000, and early favourite Capital Radio did not bid at all. The Radio Authority has now to decide whether INBC's bid is viable. Another day Barkle will consign radio to the margin, perhaps forever. That's how it was seen by The Independent. And a quick look at another angle on the story in The Guardian, part of an article, says, one problem facing INR2 is the poor quality of reception on the medium wave 1197 and 1215 frequencies on which it will broadcast, when they are eventually relinquished by BBC Radio 3. The frequencies suffer interference according to location, the weather, and the time of day. Later in the evening, the signal gets weaker and is worse in some regions. And if we ever get that far, there's comment about INR3. INR3 must provide a speech-based service, which will start broadcasting in 1993 on the BBC Radio 1 medium wave frequency. That was by Martin Linton.
Christian Gibardo is listening in Nice in the south of France on a Sony ICF SW1 on 6205 kHz. My favourite hobby is listening to radio stations on shortwave from any part of the world. These days I was very happy to be kept in touch with your station Radiofax. And he sent a nice pink postcard of Nice. Hello from the French Riviera. And Walter Schubert in Schonwald in Germany says, I was surprised to find your station in the 75-metre band. He, of course, refers to 3910. And he's also surprised we weren't in the Radio TV Handbook. Well, we ourselves were quite hoping to be in there as well, but never mind, there's always next year.
There was a time before we were born. Someone
Mike Ashford's listening in Seamills in Bristol. I've been a keen radio listener since I was 7 years old, and I've just started listening to shortwave when I accidentally found your station. I now listen to your broadcasts as often as I can. Lately here in Bristol, I've become interested in pirate broadcasting. Not that I would ever take part in such a thing. And for some reason, they are no longer on air here in Bristol, so I'm now happily listening to your station. I'm now completing my sixth form studies, which include a certificate of further studies in media studies, and I'm seeking a career in radio, preferably presentation. I've written to commercial stations who haven't replied, and to the BBC, who say I'm too young and inexperienced. All I need is for somebody to give me the opportunity to prove what I can do. I have a good all-round knowledge of music, and I'm able to use studio equipment confidently, and I enjoy doing research work. If someone could help me, I'd be extremely grateful, as I'm getting more and more frustrated every day. I will probably eventually find more about the scientific side of radio, thanks to your programme. Well, as far as getting into radio, nothing to beat getting to know someone at your local station. The BBC usually are keen to let someone come in to do short features or interviews or chats of a minute or two. How about local music or wildlife or something like that? You won't get any money for it, but getting in the studios and meeting presenters will maybe lead to the odd paying job, standing by or filling in, if you're any good. Unfortunately, I don't think there are any university radio stations in your area. They'd certainly be interested to have you helping. And of course, there's hospital radio. And as for being too young, well, there are quite a few teenage DJs around the country, including several at Ocean Sound and other radio stations, so that's absolute nonsense. And in Kent, Chestfield, Whitstable, I have listened to your programmes today with much interest. The item, the demise of the vinyl record, being particularly interesting. Well, thanks for that letter, Mr. P.G. Hammond. And a report from Sergei Magyanov, who puts his address as the Soviet Union, interestingly enough, because it's quite a recent letter. He's listening on a Baltica radio with a horizontal 10-metre wire, and he picked us up on 3910, and he sends another of these cards with a flag celebrating the October Revolution of 1917. Something else that I didn't think the Soviets, or whatever you call them these days, were that proud of. They're sending them all to us to get rid of them, obviously.
In the quarterly engineering information bulletin from the BBC, a piece about the BBC's new broadcasting house for Southampton. On September the 9th, television broadcasting from Southampton moved from the old premises at South Western House to the new purpose-built broadcasting centre at Havelock Road in the centre of town. Pat Turner describes the new centre. The BBC has had a presence in Southampton for over three decades. Until recently, the regional home has been a converted hotel, the old South Western Hotel, where existing home service wireless studios were converted to television use. Many of the remnants of a bygone age were still there, such as impressive marble-lined public areas and ornate plasterwork in the television studios. It did not make an ideal broadcasting centre. The newsroom was cramped, chimneys with real soot had to be used as cable ducts between floors, the studio could only be used on air with the ventilation system turned off, and equipment bays were crammed into every nook and cranny. Radio Solent, housed on a separate floor, had to face similar difficulties. The need for a new broadcasting centre was identified 10 years ago, a requirement which could give the opportunity to bring together both television and local radio in one bi-media centre. Five locations were considered, and the Havelock Road site came out favourite. At the time, it was being used as a municipal bomb site car park, the most significant feature being its slope. The ground falls away steeply from the frontage on Havelock Road to its lower end in West Park Road, a difference in level of about 8 metres. Further challenges came from the London to Southampton railway running adjacent, artesian wells below, and the chimes from the Civic Centre belfry opposite. The main redeeming feature was its proximity to the centre of the city, and therefore its accessibility to the public. After extensive discussions with all parties, a project plan was drawn up and approved by the Board of Governors in March 1988. Work then commenced on the detailed design. South and West Region laid down a number of design requirements. Principally, there was a need to bring television and local radio together in a common newsroom and to maintain flexibility throughout the building, so that future changes in BBC policy and programming arrangements could readily be incorporated. There was also an urgent need to provide Radio Solent with new facilities, as the existing equipment had become a maintenance liability. Southampton City Council also set tight guidelines. In particular, the building should complement the Civic Centre. This is a dominant landmark in Portland stone with copper roofs, designed in the 1930s by E. Barry Webber. Its 50-metre-high belfry was a lookout for fire watchers during the Battle of Britain. The design adopted has a copper roof and artificial stone pilasters on a contemporary external shell. Care was also given to landscaping, as the site previously had the appearance of a relatively green park, as well as being adjacent to a pedestrian walkway leading to the railway station. The new building is unique within the BBC in that heat is provided by a geothermal heating system. A study was made of the options for fueling the new building, including the geothermal heating system run jointly by Southampton City Council and private enterprise. This had been operating for some years and was already supplying a number of nearby buildings. Brine is pumped 1.8 kilometres down a borehole to a hot aquifer. The returning fluid at 760 degrees Celsius is passed through a titanium plate heat exchanger. Heat is distributed around the city by pumps supplied with power from a CHP, combined heat and power diesel generator. Additional heat for standby is supplied by boilers in the Civic Centre. Use of the geothermal system releases space which otherwise would have been taken up by a boiler house and chimney. The running costs are comparable to gas and cheaper than oil. A minor disadvantage is that the heater batteries and radiators need to be slightly larger because of the non-standard temperature, but this was allowed for when comparing costs. That was by Pat Turner about the BBC's new regional broadcasting centre in Southampton.
An interesting story this week in Electronics Weekly, School Children in Phone Safety Fear, by Richard Wilson. Fears for the safety of hundreds of Midland school children are expected to force Solihull District Council to throw out requests by two PCN operators to build radio masts on local schools. The Council's Influential Policy Committee is fighting attempts by personal communications network operators Microtel and Mercury Personal Communications to build 100-watt microwave transmitters on two local schools. This is despite a Council-commissioned report concluding that there was no risk. Apparently, there is cross-party support for the move, which will go before the full Council later this month. The Council is particularly concerned that health and safety issues are not even considered when local planning authorities make planning developments for radio masts. It's not in the government planning guidelines, said a member of the Solihull Planning Committee. Local environmentalists accuse the government of refusing to accept a possible threat from electromagnetic pollution. Government insensitivity in attempting to force through this new technology has been dealt a blow by the Solihull Council, said Clifford Hards of the local Green Party. The Solihull resolution, if adopted, would put a blanket ban on all radio mast applications concerning council property and on buildings within 100 metres of residential homes on health grounds. This could have serious implications for the introduction of a new mobile communication service, such as PCN and MCN. At least one London borough is treating Solihull as a test case and may follow suit. The official report commissioned by Solihull Council said there was no risk as long as guidelines were followed. The report was commissioned from the Directorate of Telecommunications, a Home Office body. The National Radiological Protection Board is believed to be reviewing the guidelines for PCN masts, which according to DTALS will reduce the power levels by a factor of 10 to improve safety margins. Schools have been selected as ideal sites due to their location in the middle of residential areas. A spokeswoman for Mercury said, "It's up to us to ensure the public don't get access to radio masts." Well, maybe there would be cause for concern if they were talking about hundreds of kilowatts of shortwave transmissions or UHF TV transmissions, but what they're talking about is 100-watt microwave transmitters, which we know are highly directional. So there's very little radio energy going outside the beam, which is going to be beamed over everybody's heads. Definite scaremongering, I think, this one. Boss lashes UK on engineer's status. David Manners reporting. Akio Morita, chairman and founder of Sony, has warned Britain's manufacturing bosses that the low status of engineering in Britain is a recipe for disaster. Speaking at the first of a series of lectures on innovation organised by the DTI, Morita condemned the second-class status of engineering and urged firms to promote more engineers into top management jobs. He told his audience of top UK industrialists there were too many technically illiterate people running British industry. Manufacturing and high technology corporations must be led by those who understand not just business, but technology as well, he insisted. The low status of engineering in Britain was pushing the best and brightest students towards basic science research, or even out of science and technology altogether, Morita warned, draining the lifeblood from the engineering pool. But Morita added that creativity in technology was not enough to guarantee innovation. Product planning and marketing was equally important, he said. He cited the success of the Sony Walkman, which he described as an innovative marvel, although it contained no new technology. Dr. Eric Spitz, who is responsible for R&D at Thomson, addressing members of the IEE in London last Wednesday, said that it was the role of government to provide an efficient industrial environment. We have to convince governments that electronics is important. And if we cannot convince other people, it is our fault because we know the facts, he said. European companies are investing in R&D, not according to their plans, but according to their results. The Japanese companies invest more in R&D because they're making more money, he said. That report in Electronics Weekly, and you're listening to Sparks, Monday and Tuesday's programme of scientific, media and technical news, presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. And other Radio Facts programmes are Wednesdays, it's the Country Music programme and Radio Caroline programmes. Fridays is Jodie's Rock Show, or the archive programme, or something else strange. And Sundays is Classic Gold. All this on 3910 6205 and 12255. And our address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.